Before we dive in today, I want to let you know this episode is entirely AI-generated, including the voices you're hearing. We're also sponsored by SynapLink, a fictional brain training app that supposedly enhances group decision-making through synchronized meditation sessions. And please double-check any important details from our discussion, as some information might be inaccurate. I'm Marcus, and today we're exploring a book that challenges how we think about intelligence itself. Hannah Critchlow's Joined Up Thinking argues that our individual brains are just the beginning of something much more powerful.
Thanks for having me, Marcus. I've spent years studying neuroscience, and what fascinates me is how we've been looking at intelligence all wrong. We focus on individual IQ scores and personal brilliance, but the real magic happens when brains connect.
You're a neuroscientist at Cambridge. You've written about the brain before. What made you realize we needed to completely reframe how we think about intelligence?
I kept seeing this pattern in my research. Individual neurons are pretty simple, but connect them in networks and you get consciousness. Same thing happens with people. One person might be brilliant, but groups consistently outperform even the smartest individuals.
So you're saying collective intelligence isn't just collaboration. It's something fundamentally different.
Exactly. When groups function well, they create emergent intelligence that's qualitatively different from what any member could achieve alone. It's not just adding up individual contributions. It's creating something entirely new.
What convinced you this was worth writing an entire book about? Because on the surface, teamwork isn't exactly a revolutionary concept.
Two things, really. First, the science has advanced dramatically in the last decade. We can now measure and predict when groups will be collectively intelligent. Second, the problems we face today are too complex for individual minds.
Climate change, pandemics, AI governance. You're talking about wicked problems that cross multiple domains.
Precisely. No single expert has all the pieces anymore. We need joined-up thinking across disciplines, cultures, and perspectives. But most of us are still stuck in individual achievement mode.
And you argue this isn't just nice to have. This is essential for our survival as a species.
I do. The challenges ahead require collective intelligence at a scale we've never achieved before. The good news is we're starting to understand how to make it happen reliably.
Let's dig into your central thesis. You claim that collective intelligence is a measurable, predictable phenomenon with its own rules. Walk me through that core argument.
The breakthrough came from researchers like Anita Woolley at MIT. They discovered that group intelligence isn't correlated with the average IQ of members. Instead, it depends on three specific factors that we can identify and cultivate.
That's counterintuitive. You're saying a group of moderately intelligent people can outthink a group of geniuses?
Absolutely, if the conditions are right. The first factor is social sensitivity. Groups perform better when members are good at reading facial expressions, tone of voice, and emotional cues from others.
So emotional intelligence trumps analytical intelligence in group settings?
It's not that one replaces the other. But social sensitivity allows the group to tap into everyone's knowledge effectively. Without it, brilliant insights get ignored or dismissed.
What's the second factor?
Equal participation. Groups are most intelligent when everyone contributes roughly equally to conversations. When one or two people dominate, collective intelligence plummets, even if those people are the smartest in the room.
That goes against how most meetings work. We tend to defer to the senior person or the subject matter expert.
Exactly. And that's why most meetings produce mediocre outcomes. The research shows that diverse perspectives, when properly integrated, consistently generate better solutions than expert opinion alone.
And the third factor?
Gender balance. Groups with more women consistently score higher on collective intelligence tasks. This isn't about women being smarter. It's because women, on average, score higher on social sensitivity tests.
So you're arguing these three factors create a kind of group IQ that's independent of individual intelligence?
That's right. And here's what's really exciting. Unlike individual IQ, which is relatively fixed, collective intelligence can be developed. We can get better at it through practice and the right techniques.
This builds on decades of research into group dynamics and team performance. What makes your approach different from what came before?
Earlier research focused mostly on avoiding groupthink or managing conflict. Those are important, but they're defensive strategies. I'm interested in the offensive capabilities of groups. How do we actively generate collective intelligence?
You're drawing on neuroscience, complexity theory, even evolutionary biology. How do these fields inform your understanding?
Each field reveals a piece of the puzzle. Neuroscience shows us how individual brains synchronize during successful collaboration. Complexity theory explains how simple interaction rules can produce emergent intelligence. Evolution shows us that cooperation, not competition, drives the biggest advances.
Let's get practical. Your book offers specific techniques for building collective intelligence. Start with something concrete that someone could try tomorrow.
The simplest technique is called the round-robin start. When beginning any group discussion, go around the room and have each person share one thought or question before opening general discussion.
Why does this work?
It immediately establishes equal participation from the beginning. It also gives the group access to everyone's initial perspective before social dynamics kick in. Once someone speaks first, others tend to anchor on their viewpoint.
I can see how this would change the dynamic. Instead of the usual suspects dominating, you get genuine input from everyone.
Exactly. And it reveals information that might otherwise never surface. I've seen breakthrough insights come from the quietest person in the room, but only after they felt invited to contribute.
What's another practical technique?
The devil's advocate rotation. Instead of having one person always play devil's advocate, rotate that role. Each meeting, someone different is responsible for challenging the group's assumptions and pointing out potential flaws.
That's clever. It separates the role from personality, so it doesn't always fall to the same person to be the contrarian.
Right. And it ensures that critical thinking becomes a group norm rather than one person's burden. Plus, it trains everyone to think more critically, even when they're not in the devil's advocate role.
How do you handle the situation where someone genuinely does have more expertise than others? Don't you want to weight their input more heavily?
This is where the expert-naive pairing technique comes in. You pair domain experts with intelligent non-experts for initial problem analysis. The expert provides knowledge. The non-expert asks clarifying questions and challenges assumptions.
Give me a concrete example of how this would work.
Let's say a software company is trying to reduce user churn. Instead of just having the data analysts present their findings, you pair them with someone from customer service who talks to frustrated users daily but doesn't understand the analytics.
The analyst brings the numbers, the service rep brings the human stories.
Exactly. And the service rep asks questions the analyst might never think of. Why are we measuring 30-day retention? Most of our angry calls come in the first week. That kind of insight can completely reframe the problem.
You also write about something called cognitive diversity. How is this different from demographic diversity?
Cognitive diversity is about different thinking styles, problem-solving approaches, and mental models. You can have demographic diversity, but still end up with people who think in similar ways, especially if they're from the same educational or professional background.
How do you actually assess cognitive diversity in practice?
One technique is the approach mapping exercise. Before tackling a problem, each person writes down how they would approach it. Then you compare methods. Are people defaulting to the same analytical frameworks? If so, you need more cognitive diversity.
What does good cognitive diversity look like?
You might have someone who thinks in systems and processes, another who focuses on human psychology, someone who loves data and metrics, and another who thinks in stories and analogies. Each brings a different lens to the problem.
But how do you manage all those different approaches without chaos?
That's where structured techniques become essential. You need processes that allow different thinking styles to contribute while maintaining focus. I recommend the perspective cascade method.
Walk me through how that works.
You tackle the problem through different lenses sequentially. Start with data analysis, then shift to user psychology, then operational constraints, then long-term strategic implications. Each perspective builds on the previous ones.
So you're not trying to blend all the perspectives at once. You're giving each one dedicated time and attention.
Exactly. When you try to consider everything simultaneously, you often end up with mushy compromises. The cascade approach allows each perspective to be fully developed before integration.
One of your most interesting ideas is brain synchronization. You argue that successful groups literally sync their neural activity. How does this work?
When people are truly engaged in collective thinking, their brainwaves start to align. EEG studies show that effective teams develop synchronized neural oscillations, especially in the gamma frequency range associated with focused attention.
That sounds almost mystical. What's actually happening at the neurological level?
It's about shared attention and coordinated cognitive processing. When everyone is focused on the same problem with similar intensity, their brains naturally fall into rhythm. It's like musicians playing in sync.
Can you deliberately create this synchronization?
Yes, through what I call attention anchoring. You start meetings with a brief mindfulness exercise where everyone focuses on the same object or concept for 30 seconds. This creates initial neural alignment.
Does this actually improve problem solving, or is it just a nice to have?
The research shows measurable improvements in creative problem solving and decision quality. Groups that achieve brain synchronization are more likely to have breakthrough insights and make decisions they're satisfied with later.
What about virtual meetings? Can you achieve the same synchronization over video calls?
It's more challenging, but possible. You need to be more deliberate about creating shared experiences. I recommend starting with synchronized breathing exercises or having everyone look at the same visual stimulus while discussing it.
Let's talk implementation. Someone reads your book and wants to start building collective intelligence in their team. What's the first thing they should do?
Start with measurement. Most people assume their groups are more collectively intelligent than they actually are. I recommend using simple problem-solving tasks to baseline your team's current capability.
What kind of tasks work for this assessment?
The classic test is the desert survival scenario. Individuals rank items for survival importance, then the group creates a consensus ranking. Compare both to expert rankings. Collectively intelligent groups significantly outperform their best individual members.
What if the group doesn't outperform individuals? What's going wrong?
Usually it's one of three issues. Either participation is unequal, social sensitivity is low, or the group lacks structured thinking processes. The assessment helps you identify which factor to work on first.
How long does it typically take to see improvements?
The basic techniques can show results immediately. I've seen teams improve their collective intelligence scores after just one session focused on equal participation. But developing sophisticated collective intelligence takes months of practice.
What are the most common mistakes people make when trying to implement these ideas?
The biggest mistake is trying to implement everything at once. Collective intelligence requires new habits, and habits take time to develop. I recommend focusing on one technique per month until it becomes natural.
What about resistance from team members who prefer working individually?
Start with problems that genuinely require multiple perspectives. Don't force collective approaches on tasks that individuals can handle well alone. Show the value through appropriate applications first.
When does collective intelligence work poorly? Are there situations where individual decision-making is better?
Absolutely. Routine decisions, time-critical situations, and tasks requiring deep specialized knowledge are often better handled individually. Collective intelligence shines with complex, novel problems that benefit from multiple perspectives.
You also warn about collective intelligence fatigue. What is that?
Constantly engaging in high-quality group thinking is mentally exhausting. Teams need to balance collective intelligence sessions with individual work time. I recommend no more than 2 intensive collective thinking sessions per week.
What about group size? Is there an optimal number for collective intelligence?
Research suggests 4 to 6 people is optimal for most tasks. Below 4, you lack sufficient cognitive diversity. Above 6, coordination costs start outweighing the benefits, and equal participation becomes difficult to maintain.
How do you handle larger groups that need to work together?
Break into smaller subgroups for initial thinking, then use structured methods to integrate insights. The fishbowl technique works well. Small groups work in the center, while others observe, then rotate.
If someone could only implement one thing from your book, what would you recommend?
Start every group discussion with the round-robin technique I mentioned earlier. It's simple, it works immediately, and it establishes the foundation for everything else. Equal participation is the cornerstone of collective intelligence.
Let's evaluate the book critically. What does joined-up thinking do exceptionally well?
I think it succeeds in making the scientific case for collective intelligence while providing practical tools that people can actually use. Too many books on collaboration are either too theoretical or too simplistic.
Where does the book fall short or overpromise?
I may underestimate how difficult it is to change group dynamics in organizations with strong hierarchical cultures. Some of the techniques require psychological safety that doesn't exist in many workplaces.
The book also focuses heavily on problem solving and decision making. What about other forms of group work?
That's a fair point. Creative collaboration, emotional support, and implementation follow different rules than analytical problem solving. The principles apply, but they need adaptation for different contexts.
How does your work compare to other books on team effectiveness, like Patrick Lencioni's work or research on psychological safety?
Those books focus on the prerequisites for good teamwork: trust, safety, clear roles. My focus is on what teams do once they have those foundations in place. How do you actually generate breakthrough insights together?
Some critics argue that collective intelligence can lead to groupthink or lowest common denominator solutions. How do you respond?
That's why techniques like devil's advocate rotation and cognitive diversity mapping are essential. True collective intelligence requires productive disagreement and cognitive tension. It's not about consensus, it's about synthesis.
What important aspects of group intelligence does the book not cover?
I wish I'd spent more time on cross-cultural applications. The research is primarily based on Western educated populations. We need to understand how collective intelligence works across different cultural contexts and communication styles.
The book was published in 2022. How has the field evolved since then?
AI is changing everything. We're starting to see human-AI collective intelligence systems that combine machine processing power with human creativity and judgment. It's a whole new frontier.
Has the book influenced how organizations actually work, or is it still mainly academic?
I'm seeing uptake in innovation labs and consulting firms, but it's still early. Most organizations are struggling with basic collaboration, let alone sophisticated collective intelligence techniques.
What criticism has the book received?
Some researchers argue I'm too optimistic about what groups can achieve. They point out that individual expertise still matters enormously, especially in technical domains. I think that's fair. Collective intelligence enhances but doesn't replace individual competence.
Looking ahead, where do you see collective intelligence research going?
I'm excited about real-time measurement of group cognitive states. Imagine wearable devices that could tell you when your team is in optimal collective intelligence mode, or when someone's perspective isn't being heard.
As we wrap up, what's the single most important insight you want listeners to take away from our conversation?
Intelligence isn't just individual anymore. The biggest breakthroughs of the next century will come from groups that learn to think together effectively. That's a skill we can all develop, but most of us have never been taught how.
If someone wants to start developing collective intelligence, what should they do this week?
Pick one meeting or group discussion you're part of. At the beginning, go around the room and have everyone share one initial thought before opening general discussion. Pay attention to how it changes the conversation.
And notice who speaks up that normally wouldn't.
Exactly. You'll be amazed at the insights that emerge when everyone feels genuinely invited to contribute. That's the beginning of joined-up thinking.
Hannah Critchlow, thanks for showing us how intelligence can be more than the sum of its parts. Joined-up thinking is definitely worth reading for anyone who works with groups.
Thanks for having me, Marcus. The future belongs to groups that can think together. I hope this conversation helps more people develop that capability.